Welcome back to the Token Intelligence Show. John, one concept that you and I love is this concept of mental models.
Yes.
And we have actually used these mental models as a way to sort of navigate a lot of questions about AI. And we talked about a mental model on the very first show that we recorded. And we thought that we would just do some dedicated episodes to exploring these mental models.
Yes. Bottlenecks was the first one we did.
Bottlenecks was the first one. And for those of you who didn't catch the first episode, mental models actually stem from Charlie Munger of, you know, Berkshire Hathaway fame. And there's a guy named Shane Parrish who was a disciple of Charlie Munger's. And Shane Parrish uncovered this, not uncovered, I mean, it was fairly widely known, but Charlie Munger had this belief that if you studied all of these different disciplines in the world, you could derive mental models from different disciplines and then use those to apply those mental models, you know, as appropriate for decision-making and problem-solving.
Yep.
And so the thesis is, okay, if you have a good handle on these mental models, which give you a foundational understanding of how things work, then you're way better at decision-making and way better at problem-solving because you're sort of using these baseline, you know, mental models. And Charlie Munger said that there are probably 80 or 90 models, you know, that you need to know. And then, you know, a small fraction of those, let's say 5 or 10, really carry most of the freight, I think is the term that he used.
Have that short list like in your mind? Because I don't think that I do. I have my favorites, I would say, but I haven't quite shortlisted.
I haven't finished reading the full series, because the first couple books, there's so much meat in there that I tend to keep returning to those.
Right.
So I don't know. We'll do that in a That'd future episode is try to like shortlist the models.
Yeah. This is a top one though. This is a fun one.
Yeah, this is absolutely in the top several for me. Shane Parrish, though, ran a blog called Farnham Street. Farnham Street is a nod to Berkshire Hathaway. So, you know, in Nebraska, where Warren Buffett lives. And he explored all sorts of topics. He has a great podcast called The Knowledge Project. He explored all sorts of topics, but he really dug into mental models and ended up writing a book series called The Great Mental Models. And actually, we have one right here. We'll show it to those of you on video.
That is the one.
This is volume 3, Systems and Mathematics. So actually, here I can put this up here. That's not centered, sorry.
There we go.
Your
camera's like moving around.
It is moving around. Yeah, but volume 1 is general thinking concepts. Volume 2 is physics, chemistry, and biology. Volume 3 is systems and mathematics. And volume 4 is economics and art. So bottlenecks came from volume 3. But we're actually going to talk about the mental model called The Map Is Not the Territory. And it is, the very first model in the very first book from General Thinking. And it's a great one. So you wanted to frame this
with a question,
which I think is a really compelling question.
Yeah. So pretty much my entire business career, I've heard this business platitude that I think conflicts a little bit with this, right? So I think a lot of you have heard it too. So the mental model today that we're talking about is called The Map Is Not the Territory.
Yep.
But a lot of times in business, I've heard this probably at every job I've ever had, is perception is not reality. So that's what I want to dig into. We're going to go into the model first so you can better unpack what the map is not the territory. But in the back of your mind, and what I've been thinking about, is like, wait, but if perception is not reality, how does that fit in with this?
Right. Well, let me ask you a question, and you can defer this to later in the show if you want there to be a big review.
Yeah.
Do you generally agree with the idea that perception is not reality? Or sorry, that perception is reality?
I don't know. I've gone back and forth on it. Truly.
Okay. Yeah.
Truly, where early on when I first heard it, I would say vehemently disagreed. Then, like, as I progressed, like, I see the aspects where it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't think I can give a, like, full answer to it.
What you're saying, it sounds very much like when it comes to perception being reality, that the map is not the territory.
Yeah.
And distilling complexity is hard. That was meta. You're welcome.
Yeah, that was super meta. Wow.
You're welcome.
But let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Because I think everybody has a different context for that phrase, perception is not reality. And I think for some people, it's actually immensely helped them. And for other people, like, not so much. My original, like, founding perception of hearing this, my very first job, and this is so funny looking back on it. My boss comes in, or boss's boss, I think, comes into the room.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one of those, like, let me teach you a story. You know, I was really, or let me teach you through a story type of moments. It's like, all right, early on in my career, when I was in the military,
mm-hmm.
I was working with a team. We were in charge of this warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
We had to inventory everything every week, kind of manage a warehouse, right?
Yep.
And, you know, at times it was really busy and hectic, but there's other times, like, we had a lot of downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what my, you know, manager or whatever the position was at the time.
Commanding officer.
What he taught me is that regardless of what was happening, you needed to look busy. And the hack was you needed to have a clipboard and a pen or a pencil in your hand at all times when you're walking around. So if you're walking around aimlessly, clipboard and pencil. If you're actually doing work, clipboard and pencil. And then he just walks out. So it's like
early in your career.
So it was like, I'm a couple months into my first job.
Wow.
And, like, walks out and you're like, the lesson, the takeaway is, like, perception is reality, and then walks out. And I'm just sitting there like, I don't know what to think about
perception
this.
Is reality. Mic drop. I'm gone.
Yeah.
Did you go buy a clipboard?
No, I didn't. I had a notebook, which maybe is similar in a business context.
Yeah.
But it was so, and his point to us was, like, you guys should look busy even if you don't have work to do.
Yeah.
That was his point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tie it into perception is not reality.
Okay. All right. We're going to test perception as reality through this mental model. So
yeah.
I'm going to read from Shane Parrish's source material on The Map Is Not the Territory. So select quotes from The Map Is Not the Territory. The map of reality is not reality. Even the best maps are imperfect. That's because maps are reductions of what they represent. If a map were to represent the territory with perfect fidelity, it would no longer be a reduction and thus would no longer be useful to us. A map can also be a snapshot from a point in time representing something that no longer exists. We use maps every day to simplify complexity. A great example is the financial statements of a company, which are meant to distill the complexity of thousands of transactions into something manageable. Yet they tell us nothing about whether the product is good for the customer or what's really going on in the company. A policy document on office procedure, a manual on parenting a two-year-old, or your performance review. All are models or maps that simplify some complex territory to guide you through it. Relying solely on maps can lead you to the wrong conclusion. You need to actually touch the territory. And then the post goes on to say, some of the biggest map territory problems are the risks of the territory that are not shown on the map. When we're following the map without looking around, we trip right over these risks. Any user of a map or model must realize that we do not understand a model, map, or reduction unless we understand and respect its limitations. If we don't understand what the map does and doesn't tell us, it can be useless or even dangerous. In order to use a map or model as accurately as possible, we should take into account three important principles. Number one, reality is the ultimate update. Number two, consider the cartographer. And number three, maps can influence territories. And I'll just give a brief, I'll read a, like a brief sentence or two on each of these.
Reality is the ultimate update.
Yep.
Consider the cartographer, so the map maker.
Yep.
Maps can influence territories.
Yep.
Got it.
So, for reality is the ultimate update, a map captures a territory in a moment in time, just because it might have done a good job at depicting what was at that what was at the time it was made, there is no guarantee that it depicts what there is now or what there will be in the future. The faster the rate of change in the territory, the harder it will be for a map to keep up to date. Consider the cartographer. Maps are not objective creations. They reflect the value standards and limitations of their creators. And then maps can influence territories. A model can influence the decisions we make in the territory when we try to fit complexity into our own simplification, mm-hmm. or our own model of simplification. So I thought what we could do to break this down is go through each of these points. And each of us can kind of give an example or two about how we're seeing this play out. And I think this is particularly important because we're going through such a big change,
right,
with AI, where the territory is changing rapidly. And so a lot of maps are having to be thrown out and recreated. So,
yeah, well, and we were talking about this before the show. All three of these points are actually really relevant for the current AI, like
investment landscape.
Investment landscape, the what reality is versus perceived reality, like, yep, it's all interconnected, yeah. I think.
So let's do that. Let's just break down how these relate to AI, and then let's give some maybe examples from our careers, you know, or even personal lives that relate to this. So reality is the ultimate update. I think when I think about AI and reality as the ultimate update for the map is not the territory, I'm going to give a very specific example here. I'm gonna think about the person who started out very skeptical of AI.
Yes.
You know, sort of the most vocal of these people wrote blog posts, you know, or social media posts about, you know, the limitations and the problems, you know, and all of the danger inherent in non-deterministic, you know, generation, et cetera, who progressively over time were forced by reality to update their map of,
right,
what AI is useful for,
right,
and what it's capable of.
Right.
And so, but interestingly, like we talked about in the sunk costs episode, which was our previous episode,
right,
there are a lot of people who are not updating their map. They're not actually using reality to update their map.
Right. Well, and I think the trickiest part for anybody, me included, in reality is the ultimate update, is sorting out what I want to believe to be true versus what is true.
Mm.
And
getting,
being honest enough with yourself to figure out the difference. And sometimes reality will align with what you want to believe is true. And sometimes it won't.
Unfortunately, that is, as you get older and each decade passes, you progressively realize that the delta is
larger than you ever could have imagined.
Okay, consider the cartographer. Break that down for me as far as AI.
Yeah, so this one I think is really complex. So consider the cartographer, the map maker. So I think it would be fair to say that a lot of the companies building the frontier models, mm-hmm. these large AI companies, are kind of the cartographers of the day,
yep,
or the thought leaders in the space, which there's a big overlap there.
Yep.
So they are absolutely influencing, you know, so to consider the cartographer is essentially talking about bias. Like, if you created the map, you as the map maker are interpreting reality through your own lens and creating a map.
Yep.
So I think there's a big consideration here is if you have invested billions of dollars into AI, like, you want it to work. You want it to be true.
Yep.
You want to just continue to kind of amp up the potential gains, the potential outcomes, all of that. So I think it's such a big deal right now to think about that.
It really is, because I think about ROI, which, you know, ROI for not only the frontier models and the people who are funding them, but also, you know, the companies that are purchasing, you know, AI products, tokens, API access, that need to prove, you know, some sort of ROI from this. And so that actually, I think, leads well into point number three: maps can influence territories. So one of the things I've been thinking about here with AI is that You know, you and I have both talked about how we believe that AI is going to unleash a gigantic boon in economic creativity, because it is such a powerful tool and capable of so many different things across so many different disciplines. But really the main impact that it is currently having is productivity and knowledge work. And I would argue specifically that
software engineering
that over-indexes for software engineering, right, in the current state. And so that, I think, is because, like, the map is influencing the territory in that the map that I think all of the money that has been put into this, the map that they have is figuring out the quickest path to ROI.
Yes.
And the quickest path to ROI is knowledge worker productivity, right? Is like sort of increasing, you know, increasing leverage, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
That could be through output, that could be through cost optimization, et cetera, right? But that's absolutely influencing the territory. And I think that's why you've seen the most successful tools all, you know, as we think about investment, Silicon Valley, and the tech space, almost all of the tools are related to increasing knowledge worker productivity,
right?
That have been like successful on a large scale, you know, which is super interesting. So that map is absolutely influencing the territory, even though AI is capable of, you know, all sorts of different things beyond, you know, just knowledge worker productivity.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge thing. And like you said, the subset of like software engineering is even more concentrated inside of knowledge work. Primarily because in a lot of ways it's easier.
Yep.
The when you get to other knowledge work, it's just messier. Like you've got stuff in people's brains, you've got stuff in messy formats like email. Whereas in a lot of ways the knowledge work that's most organized is code.
Yep.
Like that's the most organized knowledge work.
Yes.
And because of that, that's why I think it's the biggest, the first frontier.
Sure.
Because of that.
Right. And the data is more easily accessible, right?
Yeah, sure.
Code is the most, it is the most documented output of knowledge work probably in history.
Well, and the other thing too, just to be really distill like what AI is good at, like really good at reading fast. Can you read in your native language faster or can you read code faster?
Yep.
I mean, native language, but not just you, but I think even some like really like talented developers, it's still their native language.
Yep.
So there's that. And then writing, think about that same thing. Like which one can you do faster?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a really interesting like trade-off even for people that are really literate in whatever language they maybe write code in. I think most people, they're still like faster in their native language if they can communicate in that. And there's still a translation process that nobody thought much about, where they have to go to the meetings and speak in English and they have to go away and write in code. There's still this translation process that when you find something that's like essentially not any slower in reading in English versus in Python, same with writing, not really any slower in writing in English versus Python. Like it's a huge opportunity.
Yep, and totally agree.
I think a lot of the money's focused on that. And they're expensive people. That's the other thing.
Yes.
The ROI problem of like if you look at your headcount for an organization, you know, software engineering or technical people do tend to be more expensive. So that's the other reason why there's a kind of a target there, I think.
Yep. Okay, let's talk about some lessons from our careers where we either sort of understood that the map is not the territory or did not take that to heart. So I'm going to let you choose one of the three principles here and share an anecdote, and then I can take one.
I mean, I think I have to get back to the perceptionist reality thing.
Yeah.
Really.
Are you any more convicted about the truth of
here?
That?
And this isn't like other than like the example kind of already gave from one of my first jobs.
Yeah.
I think it's a reality to be aware of and a horrible principle to live by. It's kind of my like best way to communicate what I think about it.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible principle to live by in that like if perception is reality, that means that things that people can't see are less important or maybe not important at all. And if you really are living by that, I think you end up with some pretty deep character problems and some like deep like incongruity in your life.
Yep.
So I think horrible principle to live by. Really helpful thing to be aware of is in just being, honestly, the upside of it, the better part of it, is being better able to understand what other people are perceiving.
Yes.
Versus your perception.
Yep.
That's the positive of it and the necessary part of it.
Yep.
So I think that's, to me, why it's complicated, where it, in a sense you cringe at it because somebody's going to like center their life around the principle. It's
right.
like super destructive.
Right.
But if somebody's going to completely ignore it for what it is, as far as like, that's a problem too.
Yeah. I think that the way that this has played out for me is that I think that before I started to understand that the map is not the territory, I would use my map of expected behavior out of people given the defined inputs, right? So you have okay. a certain context, you have a certain motivation or incentive. And so, you know, you have a map in your mind of how someone's going to behave or handle a certain situation.
Yes.
When there's deviation from that map, that's difficult to understand, right?
Right.
This is like reality is the ultimate update. And so
right.
I remember experiencing this, you know, we had some friends years ago who were going through some like very difficult, you know, relational problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a map of why that was, you know, I had a map of why that was happening. And the way things unfolded, like dramatically deviated from that map. And one of that is, I think, and I almost remember the moment specifically when perception is reality clicked for me, where I realized like, okay, there are some objective things happening here, but the perception of these people involved is different from the objective reality, yet they are behaving according to their perception, right? And so
yeah.
they were operating within the reality that was best reflected by their perception or their map, you know? And so I was like, oh, right.
So like, you feel like you as a third party, you're like, I can see what's going on here. And then you also like start to understand what they think is going on.
Correct.
And kind of feel that tension.
Correct.
Essentially.
Yep. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, like I kind of shared the clipboard example, updated like something that where I learned. So that was the one side where it's like, you know, you're kind of repulsed by that example.
Yes.
It's like, no,
right.
like somebody's eventually going to figure out that like, we're not actually that busy and they're going to like adjust to the problem. It probably would have been better to just like,
yep.
you know, but the opposite example, a couple years later in my career, is we were making some pretty important software selection with a pretty decent chunk of investment for the company
mm-hmm.
that we were at. We're, you know, buying a piece of software and did evaluations and picked something. And it was like back in the days where like, you know, pretty long implementation process and like pretty high, you know, capital investment.
Yep.
So get through that. And then I was one of the people that actually had mm-hmm. to use the software. I'm like, this is not very good. And it was back in the days where you kind of did demos and you got a flavor for it, but mm-hmm. like you didn't necessarily get to have hands on it until you bought it.
Yep.
And I was getting that sense. I'm like, okay, this is kind of buggy. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you're going down that road. You're like, oh no, we just spent a lot of money on this, right?
Yeah.
Then
there are a lot of zeros there.
There's a lot of zeros
early
there.
In your career.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was IC or like a team lead or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then this other piece of software comes out, cheaper, way better to use. Like essentially if you evaluate something on cost, it's better. If you mm-hmm. evaluate on end user experience, it's way better. Mm-hmm. If you'd evaluate it on developer experience, it's also better.
Mm.
So like all three, but as you can imagine, you just spend a bunch of money on implementation.
Yep.
You bought some software and you're under contract for
yep.
however many years, maybe it might've been 2 years at the time.
Wow.
That's a tricky situation.
Yes.
That I probably should have handled better. But I essentially went down the road of like, look, we made the wrong decision. Like we should go ahead and like use this other tool
mm-hmm.
because it was something that was like impacted the company's perception with customers and all
yep.
these things. And I hate that we made this decision. Like we just got to do this. So, but for, you know, for my boss and the people above me, mm-hmm. like they're not seeing it that way, right? They're seeing like, we got to stand behind our investment. Like we don't want to be wrong.
That was
like,
their map, right?
Yeah, that was their map. And it was a good learning for me. I definitely should have like better considered that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Now, putting myself in their shoes, I still think the right thing should have been to just be honest and be like, hey, this is a newer tool. We weren't aware of it. Like,
because in aggregate, the savings from using a better tool over 2 years is going to be way higher, right?
Just the customer experience and the like, and setting us apart is like a better solution or whatever. Or at least it should have been like evaluated openly versus like, this is what we have. We're not even going to consider it. So there's two sides to it, but it was a good learning and the perception is reality piece for me. And that like, we want to maintain this perception that we're competent. We made the right decisions. Mm-hmm. We know what we're doing. Whereas reality, like we screwed up.
Yeah, totally. Okay. I have one more to add here, which is for consider the cartographer. So which leads right into that, because I do think a lot of the deviation between map and territory that we see in the context of what you just talked about is, you know, people will call it sort of the pejorative term is like kingdom building within a company, right? Kingdom building, you know, sort of building a fiefdom, right? And so you have a map and that's just how you sort of try to force reality into the map, which is also like maps can influence territories. Yep. But consider the cartographer. Okay, there was a startup my friend was telling me about. They were in, you know, a leadership team meeting. Mm-hmm. And the quick background is that the market had shifted. The market was shifting more towards, you know, sort of after the zero interest rate bubble. And the market is shifting much more towards, you know, self-service and, you know, sort of like forcing a lot of companies to go back and reconsider PLG, you know, type motions as a component of their go-to-market, you know, because, you know, companies weren't flush with cash to spend on software anymore, right? And so being able to charge like, you know, being able to charge sort of whatever you wanted within reason.
So you're saying considering these models of like, oh, we can't afford to pay all these like salespeople and account management people. Like we need to like better enable self-service essentially.
Well, I think even deeper than that, the market was producing a bunch of companies who were building really good products with like a lower price self-serve type motion, right?
Oh, okay.
And so you're competing more heavily against those types of companies, right? Which is really hard when you've built a company, you know, around a sales-led motion.
Right.
And so
a more people-intensive process.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And so competition's increasing, there's pricing pressure, right?
Yep, got it.
And so that's the territory. And so in this leadership meeting, the CRO, Chief Revenue Officer, had done a bunch of work and made a very compelling and like mathematically accurate case for, you know, the way that we actually break through the next barrier of growth is to increase average contract value. Right?
Okay.
So we need to go from, I mean, I'm just going to make up numbers here because I don't know the numbers, but let's just say average contract value is like the typical SaaS 20 grand.
Yep, 20 grand.
we need to go from 20 grand, like if we can get that up to like 50 grand or 60 grand and we maintain the same close rates, that's like, that's actually the catalyst for what, you know, what changes the business, which was mathematically true. And apparently it was, you know, that, I believe that that strategy won the day because it was an airtight, you know, mathematical case based on our own data, based, you know, based on this person's experience.
Right.
But the reality on the ground was the market dynamics are changing. And so even if that was true in theory, the pricing pressure in the market wouldn't allow that to happen. And so it was just really interesting because if you step back and think about it, the cartographer makes their money through commission on contracts, right? And so, and I'm not saying that person, you know, they were making a decision that I think made sense with all the inputs that they have. Maybe they were denying reality of like what the shifts in the market.
Right.
But either way, they are incentivized to build a map that optimizes for commission, right?
Right.
Which means that if ACV goes up, like, you know, it sort of benefits right. them. And yeah. it was also true that that right. would, you know, could change the financial trajectory of the company.
Yeah, it benefits the company too. If it were to have happened in that way, then great. It's good. Exactly. It is good for everyone.
Right.
But as far as the cartographer bias, like it's yes. pretty strong there.
Yeah, exactly.
And even it's strong for another reason. It is less work to do it that way.
Yes.
That's, I think that's the biggest bias here, is you could technically get there two different ways. So say if it's just a number, mm-hmm. it's like, great, we can land 20 large accounts or 100 mid-market accounts or
yep.
500 smaller accounts. I mean, small, like less is
sure.
easier.
Sure.
So there's
absolutely.
The other piece. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep.
Alrighty. Well, that has been The Map Is Not the Territory on mental models on
it's
token intelligence. It's a good one. And we will catch you on the next show.